SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour two. Steve Askin going to join us at the bottom of the hour. We are looking maybe to get Tony Black and also looking forward to a first-time visit. I'll save that for the appropriate moment. But I want to let everybody know the anticipated get-together here at Saratoga for Leroy Jolly will take place next Tuesday, noon to 4 at Longfellow's. And the family and friends will be together and invite people to swing by and pay respects. Leroy, one of the horsemen that it meant a lot to me to have him visit the show and share his vast knowledge and, of course, a huge impact on racing history, and very stoically last summer he was ill and really did not. As would be his wont, did not really let it out much that that he was suffering, and I did before he passed, we Tina and I said we have to go down to Albany Met and. And I'm glad I did, and got a chance to see him. He's a fascinating person, and I think difficult to get to know. One of those people that had an intimidating presence, but that was a lot of it was. I don't know if it was just a defensive posture, a defense mechanism. I don't know. But if you made the effort, he was actually easy to get to know and very generous with. I mean, with me particularly, I treasure those conversations and. Yeah, the chance if there was anniversaries of things to reach out and he would, he would tell you everything you wanted to know about all the great horses and his Hall of Fame career. So Tuesday, a week from yesterday, this past I'm losing track of days, and Tuesday actually going to be busy. It's Travers Week and. The timing actually is good, noon to 4 at Longfellow's. 5 o'clock, I believe, or 5 or 6, they will draw the Travers at the Adelphi, I think in the courtyard of the Blue Hen. I think that's where it is, and I'm imagine that it's an invitation circumstance. It has been the last few years. First time, obviously, at the Adelphi, at the remodeled, and the Adelphi making quite the splash, actually. It's really beautiful what they did. And they spent a lot of money, and restored to its Gilded Age splendor. Really, one of the throwback properties, certainly back to the era of the Grand Union Hotel and the United States Hotel and, you know, virtually every, for all the great stakes that were named, actually, off for the hotels, the Grand Union and the United States were both big stakes in their day. The Adelphi will host the Travers Draw next week. And that Travers Field, people getting excited. And then we'll turn our attention after the Travers and after the Pacific Classic. One of the next, you know, next big thing is down in Philadelphia, where we'll convene with Tony, who joins us now. Tony Black and the Cotillion and Pennsylvania Derby will be the next big focus in September. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, the Cotillion and Pennsylvania Derby, as fast as this summer is going by, it'll be Cotillion Pennsylvania Derby Day real soon. I guess I won those races. In fact, you're the one who reminded me I did win the Cotillion, but and the Pennsylvania Derby. I realized I did win that in '96 because I got a picture hanging on my wall. But it's amazing that we have $2 million races and, at Parks. I guess I won them too soon, though. They were 50 and 200,000. And the Cotillion was 50,000, but it was a thrill to win. It didn't matter if it was a million or 50,000. It was always a thrill to ride in those races, and especially to win them.
Well, and it's unique or unusual, at least, the way in which stakes, some manage to catch a wave, and they end up ascending the way the Cotillion did, and you know, others obviously a function of having a revenue stream, you know, to throw money at, but it's also a lot of its timing and the placement on a calendar. And you know, the Pennsylvania Derby, they made a tremendous decision, the team at Goodwood, and what they did moving that race, making it into the final three-year-old opportunity moving toward Breeders' Cup, that was a really smart move, and moving it off of Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, Greenwood Racing was certainly well-advised, and let's not give credit to the one who advised them, Sal Sinatra. He's sure. The one who moved it, and he advised them, and it is. It's come up where it's a good prep race to anyone who would want to go into the Breeders' Cup. The top horses show up for Pennsylvania Derby. I mean, we came real close a few years ago to getting American Pharoah, but it didn't develop. But, you know, it was a logical spot to run if you're running in the, you know, and you're into the Breeders' Cup. And who knows, if things had worked out different, we might have wound up making up for it by getting Justified this year. But, you know, of course, that's not going to happen since he's retired. But it's always nice to see some of the heavy heads come from the West Coast. The one day, the last time Mike Smith rode West Coast there and won the race, and he was in the jocks room telling stories, and it was good to see Mike Smith, and his dad and I were really close and good friends. But, you know, it really brings in top horses and riders, and it generates a lot of interest in racing. You know, when you got some of these good horses show up, the public shows its appreciation, and they go out there in droves and spend money and bet money.
You know, and Tony, there's some very interesting connections. I didn't even think about bringing this up per se, but just used it as an introduction to the visit. But it just so happens, you know, I just was talking about Leroy Jolly, and there'll be a celebration of his life next Tuesday at Longfellow's, and another legend that you rode for when it came to the Cotillion win. You won on Suede Shoe, an Ack-Ack daughter, and they're going to run the Monmouth Oaks this weekend. She was third in the Oaks before the Cotillion win, and you rode for Frank Whiteley here, and for Peter Brandt, who owned Suede Shoe, and Peter Brandt very much back in the game in a big way after a fairly extended absence.
Yeah, I was really fortunate to wind up riding for some you know, well-known trainers, trainers that will never forget their names, Frank Whaley, Alan Jurgens, Leroy Jolly. I rode, I'll never forget the day I rode a Leroy Jolly trained horse. What a summer. I just, Garden State had burned down. I went to New York to ride a few horses that were just running, and we were filling in some time before we went to Atlantic City and finished out the you know, Garden State meet Atlantic City, however they did it that year. There was a lull of a few weeks, and one day I won a race on a horse called On a Duel, I believe, for Danny Lopez. And I'm walking back to the jocks room. I'm done, and Leroy Jolly walked up to me. He said, put you on a horse in a handicap. You want to ride that horse in the, I guess it was a handicap, or the stake, whatever it was. He says, what a summer. I said, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me? He said, well, I saw you're done, but she's in the eighth race. And I said, man, I thought the guy was, like, joking after, you know, or just, you know. And I went up to a clerk of scales and said, put me on the horse in the what a summer in the eighth race. He says, well, I'll have to hear from Leroy first. I said, well, I'm going to hang around till you get in touch with him. So then he called up, and yeah, he says, no, I put Black on the horse. And she just whistled, and you know, I, like I said, I was fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. At times, you know, I look back at the career and, you know, rode some horses for Leroy, rode some horses for Frank Whiteley, had some, rode some horses for Alan Jurgens, and he would send horses to Merlin to a man named Richard Zimmer, who was one of his assistants at one time during his career. So I rode for him, and I thought, yeah, it hit me one day. I says, I wonder why I never got, when I never made the transition and tried New York. But, you know, it was a couple reasons. Probably one of the reasons I didn't is because it was nice to be at one racetrack. It was racing year-round, and you could raise a family. Maybe at other times in my career, I wasn't doing the right thing and acting right, and it was bad timing to go any place. And, you know, I was just staying at Philadelphia Park, Keystone, Jersey. Maybe we'd go to Merlin. And then New York is so intimidating at times. I mean, not at times. It's, you know, it's premier racing. And you get some kid from that only thing he ever saw was been around was New Jersey, and Merlin racing, and you're a young kid, and you say, you know, do I want to take a shot and maybe fall flat on my face, or do I want to take a shot and go up there and see if I can, you know, cut the mustard and make it? But yeah, you make your decisions, and that's what you live by, and you stay in Jersey, Pennsylvania. Went to Merlin, you know, wound up going a few years in the summertime to Arlington Park, which was a thrill. But never stayed in New York. And when I think back to it, I said, "Why rode for some of these guys? You know, the heavy hits. Why didn't I?" But that's the decision. Sometimes you're a good manager, and sometimes you're a bad manager. And if I'd have fallen flat on my face, you know, I'd have been saying now, man, I should have stayed where I was one of the kingpins or one of the sure. well-known riders. Yeah, you make those decisions and you live by them. You sometimes you die by them, and sometimes they leave you wondering, scratching your head. But New York's such a great place to race, other than the traffic on the Bell Parkway. But about the when you were saying about the racing museum and Hall of Fame and everything, that man, Saratoga. Yeah, what a beautiful place to spend some weeks, and I haven't been up there in years. I might get up there one day this year. You know, the horse Collegeville Girl's going to run back up there, and Bluegrass Express. In fact, I just worked them both the day before yesterday, and they're really sitting on ready. But I think near the end of the month, there's some races for them, and Vega told me he was going to ship them both up there. And I says, well, maybe I'll go up there and watch them run, and I'll come see you. And
awesome. And, that'd be great.
Yeah, but we'll see. You know, I still got have a few weeks to decide, but they both work good. In fact, that filly, Collegeville Girl, you want me to tout her a little bit. I worked her in 47 and change the other day, and I actually looked like a jockey sitting on her back. I got some compliments from Lupe Preciado and a few of them guys. They say, you look like Lupe in his way. Look like you never quit. Look like you look good. I said, yeah, these kind of horses make you look good. Anybody can hang on and look good on these kind.
Well, coming up to Saratoga on this topic, since it came up, and let me stick with the horse at hand, that suede shoe, and you rode in the Alabama in 77.
And Sandy Hawley sawed me off going into the first turn. I'll never forget it. I saw Sandy a few months ago, but I didn't remind him of that. And I think, what was she, fourth in there?
She was fourth. She was beaten a head, a neck, and a length and three quarters. So basically two lengths for everything at 12 to 1.
Are you kidding me? I didn't know I finished that close. I still was talking about going around the first turn where Hawley come over and stood me on my head. If I'd have known I got beat that only a few lengths, I might have been really mad at him about that.
Well, the winner, of course, our Mims. And
our Mims,
How about that? Calumet, Georgie Velasquez, and Sensational was second for the people from Millhouse. And was that Ted Wallace? Tony?
Yeah.
The Wallace.
Wallace, huh?
I think Ted is Wallace. It Ted? I think it's Ted, right?
Ted Wallace.
Ted Wallace?
Who was what the
he was the jock on Sensational.
Wallace.
That was a long shot. 30 to 1.
Tommy Wallace?
All right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Man, I'll tell you what. Sometimes the names just don't stick, but I remember the name Wallace. I just can't place the first name.
Well, then Cum Laude Laurie was third.
Yeah.
This was a nice group.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, we knew it was a pretty nice group then, but as the time went by and we looked back, we realized it wasn't just nice. They were some sensational horses in that Cum Laude Laurie, our Mims, and and the jocks, you know, really. I saw Georgie Velasquez a few weeks ago, or whatever it was, a month ago. And, you know, what a gentleman. What a good guy.
He's great. Wait, I got to tell you, Tony, listen to the rest of this lineup in terms of the riders that you were shoulder-to-shoulder with. George Martens. Jean Cruguet. Steve Cawthon. Mike Venezia. Mickey Salamone. Sandy Hawley, Angel Cordero, Wallace, Georgie, and who am I missing?
You know, and to be in that group, being named in that group of riders, just for that race, or other races that I rode in, you know, it's an honor. I mean, those guys, they're the legends, the superstars of our business at my time. You know, they were, some of them were well established, some of them were, you know, well established. Velasquez and those guys, Cruguet, those guys were well established and were really tremendous riders. And then we had Steve Cawthon coming along. He was, you know, as well established, but the youngest of the group. Probably Wallace and Cawthon were the youngest of the group. They were a little younger than me. And it's something I saw I saw Steve at the Jockeys and Jeans Canterbury benefit, and he says, you know, if I'd have stayed in this country and rode, you know, I probably would have just ridden for a few years, and my weight and everything would have worked against me, and I probably would have packed it in. He says, when I went to Europe, that's what gave longevity to my career, because of the weights, you know, are heavier. And he says, and I rode for everybody over there. You know, he rode for the Queen. Rode for everybody. And, it's amazing that we watch these guys transform into great riders, you know, starting out, you know, guys like Cawthon. And it was really amazing that I got the opportunity to ride for the older ones that were well-established and the kingpins and the superstars of our business. I mean, nobody will ever forget Georgie and Velasquez, Jacinto Vasquez, Angel Cordero, you know. Nobody will ever forget those guys. You know, the same way they haven't, we're never going to forget Arcaro, Hardtack, Shoemaker, and guys like that. You know?
No doubt. No doubt.
In fact, I'm going to come up there if I get up there this year. I keep threatening. And I'm going to go to the museum just to see the plaques and the names. Even my uncle has, Sam Bolmedes has a Hall of Fame plaque. And up there, I saw it. And I remember he got inducted in the late 60s or early 70s, I forget. He retired in 67 as a jockey. But Sam Bomidas, he's even in there. So it's such a wonderful place to visit. And the atmosphere in the town. I don't care if you're there for the races or to go out and eat dinner at night or to go to the museum, the Hall of Fame. It's just a wonderful place to visit. And then you get the opportunity, if you go to the races, to see top riders and horses run in some of the greatest races in the world. I mean, you can't say enough about Travers. What can you say about Travers? He's a, group of the best three-year-olds in the world, not just the country, to show up for Travers.
No, and it's going to be an important. It's in the way things have turned with the Triple Crown winner retired.
Right.
Looking to see who steps forward. Certainly, Good Magic going to lead that group in a week from Saturday. And Tony, I appreciate it.
Let me just say one more thing. I was looking through some news articles and stuff, and I just saw where you are nominated for the Jim McKay Award. And I just hope whoever votes for that, they show you the appreciation, the respect, and everything you deserve, because you certainly have benefited horse racing. And your show puts horse racing information out there that no other show can rival. So thanks a lot for all you do, and you certainly deserve an award. If it's the Jim McKay Award, I certainly hope you receive the honor that you deserve.
I appreciate it, Tony.
Because you are an Eclipse winner.
we'll see about that. But
Tony, I'll be your press agent.
All right, we'll take it. No, thank you. Really
thank
thoughtful.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Tony, get up here. I want to see you up here at the end of the meet.
We're going to try. I can't promise, but we'll try. You take care. I'll be listening to the rest of the show. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Tony Black, everybody.
Let's take a bottom of the hour. Exactly a little past now, the little bottom of the hour. And Steve Haskin, going to get Haskin in here. Haskin's been banging away on the keyboard. Talk to Steve and see what he's focused in on. I saw where he wrote a nice piece about Mind Your Biscuits and Chad Summers. That was nice. And speaking of biscuits and New York, there's been so much New York bread in focus here this meet, given the graded steak wins left and right. Joe Bianca wrote a really nice piece in TDN yesterday. It's in the front page today. And I went up last night. I saw it. And I saw Joe, too. Joe's here this week. And he focused on the New York breads. The summer of the New York bread. Really nice. He talked to Rick Violette. Talked to Jeff Canizzo. Discussed the evolution and, really a lot of the same themes that Sid Fernando and I struck on yesterday regarding the New York breads. There was something else that I... where is it? Something else that I wanted to slip in here, too, before we went to the break. And it's not here. No. Oh, I mentioned... We talked about... the Breeders' Cup news. Well, the Breeders' Cup news I can slip in. Officially, you finally officially got the the worst kept secret in racing. Santa Anita, of course, next year for the Breeders' Cup 2019, then back to Keeneland for 2020, and then back to Del Mar for 2021. If you were waiting for the other shoe to fall, it's official. I think we first mentioned this in like April, back after a break with Steve Haskin.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The thoroughbred breeding industry will never be the same with the launch of Daily Racing Form's Buyer-Sire Performance Standings, presented by Darley. These groundbreaking ratings use buyer speed figures to measure a stallion's performance beyond wins and earnings, focusing on providing a measurement of a sire's true ability to produce high-quality horses. View the Buyer-Sire Performance Standings at drf.com/buyer-sire and get the true information that breeds results. That's drf.com/buyer-sire.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent the Sermon Afternoon Delights, absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade One race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're bound to wait all night. She's bound to run him up. Invested enough in it anyhow. He reaches on the garden sorting out. She curls her lips on her bow. I don't know if I'm dead or not. If you ain't.
We're back at the races, coming up on 20 to the top of the hour. Steve Haskin joining us, and Steve's had the most eclectic Saratoga summer, kind of touching on anything and everything. It included some historic perspective, Hall of Fame week. And, in fact, I want to ask Steve, because he's long been involved with the Hall of Fame, and of course, along with everyone, saw the news of a exciting project to renovate the hall. And Steve getting excited about Travers as well. Dale Roman's going to be on tonight with Steve and Dina on their talk show, their Thursday night show. And so Steve's getting into the Travers mindset. And then, of course, Alabama. We just talked a little bit with Tony Black and managed to wander into the 1977 Alabama with our Mims. And Steve, good morning.
Steve, I have nothing left to say. I mean, that was the promo covered everything.
Well, you can dot some I's and cross some T's.
Well, it has been interesting. I've tried to touch on a few things from New York breads to mind your biscuits, to all kinds of different things. So, you know, that's what Saratoga does to you. It opens your mind to all kinds of vast thoughts and interesting stories. But you mentioned Our Mims, of course. I just recently, in March, visited her grave at Calumet, which a lot of people don't get to do. I mean, if anybody ever gets a chance to go there, that cemetery will blow you away if you're anything close to being an historian. Just seeing the graves and for the big statue of Bull Lee and Citation and Whirlaway, and our Mims grave is the one grave there that's got a wreath of flowers on it. I guess people always come, they have the Our Mims organization, and a lot of people come
That's
there
right.
and they put flowers on there. Aladar's got a beautiful grave next to a big tree. It's hallowed ground, I'll tell you. It's really wonderful there. But that was a great year for Phillies. The funny thing is that, you know, Our Mims had such a great year, winning obviously all the big races in the first part of the year leading up through the Alabama. And then Darby Dan had a filly that year named Cum Laude Glory that wound mm-hmm. up winning everything after that. She won the Beldame, she won the Spinster, she won Delaware Handicap, the Ruffian. And, it looked like it was going to be close for the three-year-old championship, but Our Mims had won such historic races and was so, dominant early in the year that they gave it to her. But, when you have Darby Dan going against Calumet Farm, for the championship. But, there are two races this weekend that I need to touch on, not for the sake of the race itself, but for sort of a secondary meaning to the race. And, you mentioned the Alabama, and having just been at the Saratoga yearling sales, and, I've gone through this several times before with people paying exorbitant amounts of money for yearlings, which I still just don't understand. But, you see these, $1.2, $1.3 million yearlings. Even though their records are not that great, once in a blue moon you'll find a $1 million yearling. But, I'm looking at the Alabama field. They got eight horses in there. Four of them cost under $100,000, and two right. of the four are the big favorites in the race. I mean, one went for $80,000, one went for $20,000. Two of my homebreds. One went for $160,000, and the biggest price was $250,000, and that's one of the longest shots in the field. So I mean, it just shows you that, one thing I was saying that when I was at sales this year that they had 15 American Pharaohs that sold, including some really big prices and some lesser prices, and. Just kidding around. I was offering. I said, I tell you what, I'll give you the top five American Pharaohs, and I'll take the bottom ten, and then when they get to the races, we'll see who wins more money, my ten or your five. I tell you, I couldn't even break it down half and half, but it I've seen it over the years. Guys like Cott Campbell and Centennial Farm, they're buying everything for $150, $180, $220, $230, and they have tremendous success. To me, when you're dealing with 3,000 horses at the Keeneland September sale or so, you start looking at these horses, and all the good horses are the ones that really get lost that are selling for that kind of price, and all these monster yearlings. Once in a while, you'll see one of them come out. You'll see a tap rate or something like that. But, to me, that's why I look at Alabama, and it's a perfect example of it. So, I mean, there's a good chance that the two fillies that are going to run 1-2 are going to be, two of the lowest-priced horses, both under $100,000. And the other soapbox I've always been on obviously his horse is being retired early, and you know we just have no concept of horses reaching their peak anymore. People don't realize that horses reach their peak either at four or a lot of times at five. I mean, mm-hmm. We saw it with California Chrome. As good as he was as a three-year-old, and he had that crazy year at four, I mean, you know, he became a Hall of Famer as a five-year-old. He became a superstar. So I'm looking at the Pacific Classic. You have a horse, the favorite in the race, big favorite. You look at a horse like Accelerate. And, yeah, Accelerate was a nice horse at three and four. You know, he was a nice horse. He was, placed in several grade two, grade three horses. Look at him this year as a five-year-old. And he's a complete horse. And look at Lucky, out of an awesome again mare. You know, no reason why he wouldn't make a good stallion. You look at him this year, he's got a good chance in the Pacific Classic to become one of the few horses in history to win the Sandy the Handicap, the Gold Cup, and the Pacific Classic in the same year. And if he wins, the Pacific Classic, he's going to be right up there with Justify in the NTRA poll. I mean, you can't ignore it. And he's just become a tremendous horse as a five-year-old. You look at Bob Baffert's horse in there, a Dr. Dor, who was a total unknown through his four-year-old year. This year he's won two stakes, a grade two. He's placed in two stakes, and he's grade one placed. Nobody knew who he was until this year. Even a horse like Pavel, who, you know, was a late developing horse and was a good three-year-old. That was it. But now he really hasn't emerged as a star until he won the Stephen Foster in the middle of his four-year-old year. And obviously, the best is ahead for him. You look at a horse like Beachview this year at five. I mean, he was another total unknown. This year at five, you know, he wins the Cougar Handicap and easily beats Opportunity. Nobody knew who this horse was earlier in his career. And even the Lieutenant, you know, is a brother to Justify. Absolute unknown. Nobody knew who he was. Did absolutely nothing. This year, you know, he wins the All-American at Golden Gate and runs second in the Suburban Handicap and looks like he's coming into his own. So you look at this field, and the entire field is made up of mostly five-year-olds that are peaking now at the age of five. And to me, that also, you know, bolsters everything I've been saying about horses peaking. All these horses that are retiring will have absolutely no idea how good these horses could have been. And I know times have changed, everything economically. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not blaming breeders. I'm not blaming owners. I'm just telling the way it is.
Sure.
But it's kind of refreshing when you see a race like the Pacific Classic where you have all the horses in there peaking at five.
Right.
And the one horse that's not, is Pavel, is peaking in the middle of his four-year-old year.
Yep.
So none of these horses, nobody ever heard of it as three-year-olds.
Well, we knew, I mean, well, Pavel at least a little bit, just because he was, he was being...
Yeah, but he was nice.
Doug O'Neill had high regard, held him in high regard.
I'm just saying, but he looks like now, because then, he started off good. But, he won a grade three at Parks, and he ran well in the Jockey Club Gold Cup and the Jim Dandy. You know, and then he went into that funk where he finished fourth four times in a row. And he just totally broke out in Stephen Foster, and we'll see what he does now. But here's a horse who's capable of becoming a star at the, from his midpoint of his four-year-old on, and even on through a five-year-old if he duplicates his performance in the Stephen Foster, because he had never run that well before in his career. So it looks like he's just finding himself. So I mean, I just find it very very interesting, and it's kind of refreshing to see a race like that. So those are my two big soapbox races.
No, they're good. It's a good topic, and yesterday Shug was on, and we had a wonderful conversation. The occasions in recent years, especially where we've had discussions with him about that group of horses that all got good. The same way, and he's the
he's really the poster trainer for, you know, having the right kind of ownership that is in no rush, and that if Shug says, you know, we're not going to get much done, you know, with this one as a sophomore, we're going to have to wait on him, and you know, you end up with the point of entries and data link and so forth, you know, that sequence of horses that you know, that got good as 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, you know, and particularly the, you know, the turf horses, and Boisterous, and then there's another one of his in that arena, and
that's the history of the family,
right.
You know, and not just the Phipps family, but you know, the Janney family. So if you look at Stuart Janney, you know, and you look at Denny's, you know, kids who have taken over now. So I mean, it's good that it stays in the family. But the old man, Ogden Phipps, I mean, he was a total classy owner. I mean, he never, ever rushed any of his trainers. And they're like, the Phipps stable is like the Pittsburgh Steelers. I mean, look over the course of the years, you know, Pittsburgh Steelers have had, what, 3 coaches in the last 40 years or something. And you look at the Phippses, I mean, they've had so few trainers over the years, unlike so many other stables who changed trainers at the drop of a hat. But they, you know, when they had Bill Winfrey and Eddie Neloy, and now Shub's been there forever, since 1985, I believe it is. So if you look at the history of that family, and the one thing about Mr. Phipps is that, you know, every day you go into the backstretch at Belmont, at the Belmont Park, and his car was parked right outside Shug's office, right on the main road. He'd come every day after training, like, you know, 10:30 or so. He'd go in, talk to Shug, and he would leave. But if a horse needed time, never rushed a horse. You just go back to the whole family. I mean, you just look at all the great horses that have come out of there. But you know, from Buck Pass to the Personal Ensign, Easy Goer. I mean, just so many of them, but they never rushed their horses. And even when Shug had some lean years, they never gave up on him. They never changed trainers. Look how long he's been training horses. Didn't always have terrific horses. But, you know, what happened with the Phipps family is that they adjusted. They were breeding all to their own stock for years, and they were winding up with nothing but long-distance grass horses. They'd get horses breaking their maidens at a mile and 3/8 on the turf. That was when John Russell and Angel Penner had horses. And, you know, they were mostly, Angel Penner was mostly a grass trainer. And John Russell was just there for a little while. But during those years, they weren't going anywhere. And then they branched out. They started breeding all their great mares they had. They had one of the great brood mare bands. And they started breeding all their mares to Danzig and Mr. Prospector. And that was a total resurgence. And if you look at all their horses now, you'll see Mr. Prospector in almost all the pedigrees. You'll see Danzig in almost all the pedigrees.
Yep.
And they had that incredible resurgence. And then all of a sudden, all the big stars, as soon as all those horses got into racing age, they started having all those big stars that started coming around the same time in the 80s. And it's, you know, it's basically continued. There's always a big star there. And that's why, as a reporter and a historian covering the race, to me, it was such a great story covering Orb's Kentucky Derby victory. Mm. Because here's one of the, when people forget that, you look at all the people that have won the Derby, but how hard it is. You look at him, the Phipps family never won the Derby. Alfred Vanderbilt never won the Derby. Widener never won the Derby. C.V. Whitney never won the Derby. I mean, these are the pillars of the turf. They never won the Kentucky Derby. In fact, the Phippses, you know, a lot of their horses were late developers. And early on, they had a horse named Dapper Dan, who was, you know, a long shot in the Derby and wound up finishing second. Got beat a neck in there. And they never really came close. They thought they were a cinch with Easy Goer, and they ran into a monster in Sunday Silence. But all those years of never winning the Derby, Buck Passer got hurt, never made the Triple Crown. So you look and you look and you look and you wait and you wait and you see all these well-bred horses and they can't get anything to the Derby. And then along comes Orb, you know, and partnering up with their, you know, close friend, you know, Stuart Janney, who they've always been partners with. And they come up with Orb, and I thought it was just a great story. All the patience they showed with Shug over the years. And for them to be rewarded, finally winning the Kentucky Derby after all those years, I thought, as a historian, I thought it was a great story. It's not your typical rags-to-riches story, but, you know, it's all in the mind. It's how you perceive a story. Everything can be a great story, depending on how you look at it. And to me, from a history standpoint, Orb winning the Derby was a great story, and it was very, very deserving.
Agreed. And that was one of the really pleasant sequences leading up, and you could really kind of tell it. Granted, after the Derby, it didn't pan out.
No, he wasn't right. You remember after the Derby, they sent him to the clinic in Fair Hill. I remember going to visit him after that. So obviously, you know, when you send a horse to, you know, to the equine therapy center at Fair Hill, I mean, obviously the horse is not 100%. You don't want to take a horse away from the racetrack if you don't have to. And he was never quite the same. But listen, sometimes you get a horse to win the Kentucky Derby. I remember when Grindstone was going up to the Kentucky Derby, and, you know, Bill Young had all these, you know, terrific horses since he got started in the game. And Grindstone had, he was not sound at all. He had bad knees. And I can just picture Wayne Lucas saying, look, we have two choices here. We can stop on this horse and give him a shot and have a good four-year-old, but we can run him in the Derby where we would have a pretty good shot to win the Derby. He's not going to break down or anything. He's not that, you know, he says not like he cracked sesame or so. He just had bad knees. He said, we can win the Derby, but it's possible he might not run again after that. And I could just picture Bill Young saying, look, I want to, you know, I mean, I'm in this game. He's a Kentuckian. I want to win, you know, the Kentucky Derby. Let's give it a shot and see what happens. So he wound up winning the Derby, and the horse never ran again. But I don't think Bill Young would trade that in a million years.
Sure. Well, there, you know what's amazing on that topic, and you can speak to this as well as anybody, is the miracle Derby wins of so many, you know, so many important contributors to the game. And Sea Heroes win for John Galbraith.
Oh, for sure. Look how many years. Look how close Rokeby came when they had. That was when they had Elliot Birch. How close they came in. They had tremendous. They had tremendous horses all through the years. They finally had, probably, you know, the best horse they've had in this country in Arts and Letters. And, you know, he wins the Bluegrass Stakes near, I think it was a fifth off the Round Table's track record, and wins by 15 lengths eased up. He was just getting good, and he runs into Majestic Prince, and he gets beat a neck in the Derby and a neck in the Preakness. And then he goes on, obviously wins the Belmont easily, and goes on to be a Hall of Famer and, you know, Horse of the Year. But, you know, Rokeby always had these great bred horses. He had Quadrangle, who ran into Northern Dancer, and he came back and, you know, wound up beating Northern Dancer for the Triple Crown the same way in the Belmont Stakes, and went on to, like Arts and Letters, to win the Travers. But they could not get that Derby win. And then they come up with a horse like Sea Hero, who wins the Champagne at two, and then there's it looks like a total disaster. As a three-year-old, they couldn't get him started. Mac Miller didn't know what to do with his horse. He ran him on the grass. He couldn't do anything. And then he takes him, runs him into Palm Beach on the grass, and he ran so-so. Then he runs him in the Bluegrass Stakes, and he has he doesn't have the best of trips. He has gets into trouble in a stretch, and he finishes fourth. But, you know, it's very rare that you find a horse finishing fourth. And going into the Derby, no one paid much attention to him. And I remember going to his barn, and the groom sitting out there, one of these old-time, you know, African-American grooms, and he's sitting out there. And I always listen to these guys. They're the wisest men I've ever met. And he says, this horse is doing unbelievable. And I saw that horse come out, and I saw him change day after day. The dapple started forming. That coat started glistening. And then when he won, you know, it was the Sunshine Boys, Paul Mellon and Mac Miller. Mac Miller trained for years for Charles Englehart and had a lot of top horses, couldn't win the Derby. And here, both men in their 80s wind up winning the Derby. You can't beat it. It was a great, great story. And then Theo goes on. And Theo was a very inconsistent horse. He wasn't the River Course, but he goes back and winds up winning the Travers, and he's got a statue in the paddock at Saratoga. But that was another great story. You know, you see them. Listen. You look at, of course, the most famous one was Mrs. Kenter. You know.
Yes.
How
there
old
you go.
She was.
There you
I
go.
Mean, she's
great.
Been in the game forever. In reality, going way back, and you know that whole scene of Carl Nasca calling the Derby and her finally winning it after all those years with Unbridled. I mean, was that the greatest scene ever? Watching Carl Nasca call that Derby and her reaction to winning the Kentucky Derby, because she couldn't even see what was going on. He had to point everything out to her. And then at one point, it's Unbridled. He goes there, and he points to the racetrack. He goes, there he is, right there. I mean, it just gives you goosebumps. It's great stuff. And that's what makes the Derby so great. You get those phenomenal stories, and then you get the crazy stories, like Mind That Bird and Smarty Jones, you know, where the Chapmans, you know, Pennsylvania breeders, and their trainer gets murdered, and they decide to get out of the game, and all they've got left are two Pennsylvania bred weanlings, and they said, well, we'll race these, and then that'll be the end of it. And they're looking for a trainer, and they wind up with John Service, and they wind up with one of the most popular horses in history, and it was one of the great Triple Crowns ever, you know, to come up with a Smarty Jones from that. That's where you get such, you know, variance as far as the qualities and the types of stories, you know, from the old-time owners, you know, the deserving, the icons of the turf, you know, to all these Cinderella stories that are so hard to believe. So that's what makes the Derby so fantastic.
Now, since we went in this direction, I'm going to bring up a name with you. I did with yesterday with Shug, because he ran a horse that went back to Queena. And Emery Hamilton was on track yesterday, Steve. She doesn't come out all that often.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and I got a chance to meet her. And it just so happened when Shug, you know, I got around to, you know, just talking about his current horses for the meet, and he's having a very good meet. And I brought up Queena with him, and then he actually gravitated a little bit to Lorena, the daughter. And when you look at a horse like Queena, I bring this up with you and Sid Fernando, a horse that time forgot, and not, you know, just short of being a Hall of Famer type, that, you know, had bursts of incredible brilliance, and the horses like that get lost, especially in the pantheon of Shug's career.
Well, the fact that, you know, Shug went all those years by having all those great fillies, the Hall of Fame fillies, you know, Inside Information and Heavenly Prize, and a lot of people forget Queena. I think one of the reasons they forget her is that, you know, she's not the typical Phipps distance mare. Her best distance was sprinting at a mile. And, you know, if you look at races like, you know, when she won the Ballerina, and you know, back then the Mascot was a big race in a mile.
Yes.
You know, and you look at someone, and I think she also won the Ruffian.
She did.
You know, and thing is, getting back to what I was talking about before, who was Queena by? Mr. Prospector. I mean, all those men, I tell you, you're going to find them all in there. But, you know, she had tremendous pedigree. And even though she didn't go a distance, she did win an Eclipse Award. You know, and the thing is, you know, you can go back to Her Dam, too. I mean, Her Dam was a old King Ranch family, Too Chic, who was
yes.
Tremendous mare. I mean, she produced God knows how many stakes winners. So I mean, you just go back and look at all these great families, but you know, Emery Hamilton owned Too Chic as well.
Yeah, yeah. This is all Mrs. Hamilton.
Yeah, but if you go back, you know, you go back to that King Ranch. I mean, that whole family was all the big King Ranch family, going back to Monet. Now, Dr. Fager is in that pedigree.
It's funny because she, Too Chic, and Sid brought her up too yesterday, as it happens, by Blushing Groom. Her first two foals were Mr. Prospector, Chic Shireen, and Queena. And then she really did not have another big racing filly. I mean, she had some daughters go on and produce, but not like her first two.
Right. I know. I mean, listen, a lot of times that happens. Sometimes you'll see it the other way around. You know, I mean, sometimes you'll see a mare that she'll go 5, 6, 7, 8 years, not produce anything, and then right towards the end of her career. There's a mare, Corralla. She produced like 15 foals, had nothing, and then went like 5 or 6 years and was either barren or a foal died, and I mean, she couldn't produce anything. And then finally, in an old age, she produced Damascus. So I mean, you can never tell with these mares, and you can never tell with the stallions either. Stallions start off their first year. Look at all the buyers at the sales. They fall in love with first crop stallions that have never proven themselves, and then they go crazy. I remember they did it with Mineshaft, and then Mineshaft was not a huge knockout the first year, and then they just drop him. And then these horses, now Mineshaft is having a resurgence.
Absolutely.
Awesome again. Touch Golds was another one. First crop, you couldn't buy any of the Touch Golds. And he had some really good horses. He tailed off in the second year, and then they dropped him. Now you see Touch Gold now as a lot as a broodmare sire. Awesome Again, I remember going to Saratoga. Awesome Again, nobody would bid on him. You know, they would go to the minimum of $25,000 and there'd be buybacks. Nobody was interested in Awesome Again because he wasn't brilliant. And all of a sudden, he started having a few good horses. And next thing you know, he's one of the top stallions in the country. They give up on the stallion so quickly. That's what I mean. Let's see what happens. Like, take, for example, Violence, right? Unproven stallion, they went nuts. They started buying all the Violences, and they can run. I mean, they all look good. Now let's see what happens if he can sustain it. John Neighbor always told me that a stallion doesn't prove himself until the seventh year as a stallion. That's when you can tell if these are great stallions, because a lot of them start out as great stallions for a year or two, and then they tail off. They go into slumps, just like they would as a racehorse. And then they have resurgences that, you know, at the age of 9 or 10, next thing you know, they're back again. Ghostzapper, for a while, wasn't doing anything. Empire Maker wasn't doing anything. Now they're both having resurgences. I mean, you see it all the time. You know, and then you get the horses that you don't expect. The Intermischiefs, no, you know, nobody's going to expect that. The Malibu Moons, you know, they come out, and that's why I give a lot of credit to Spencer Farm. They take these unfashionable stallions, and they wind up becoming extremely fashionable. You look at the Intermischief sell for now.
Yeah. Nobody
gave him a second thought when he went to stallion. We're going to bring to some sprinter. It didn't look like anything. But it's crazy. I mean, it's just crazy how will these stallions are perceived when they pay money for them. You look at the American Pharaohs. Let's see how long that they keep spending all that money for them. I used to cover the sale. I used to cover the Saratoga sales every year throughout the 90s. And I would see it every year. There'd be a first crop stallion that they would go crazy over. And if they don't deliver right away, instead of giving them time to develop into stallions the way you would as racehorses, they give up on them. And the horses that they were spending record prices for 1 year, you could get for, you know, $80,000-$90,000 the next year. So it's there's no formula. There's no formula, and there's no accounting for what people are going to spend money on. I just gave you the example with the Alabama. $80,000, $20,000, $60,000
No, it's encouraging.
That's the way all these horses come from.
No, and it's to be honest, it for people of a certain size and level of involvement, it's encouraging that you can compete at that price level. It gives you hope.
Right. I listen. Mike Ryan's been buying horses for as long as I can remember. But the thing about Mike Ryan, you know, Mike Ryan now has got some big clients, but I remember for years and years, Mike Ryan would, he'd be looking at yearlings for like an hour. He'd drive the grooms crazy. They'd be having him out there. He'd study these horses, and he'd be looking at them. And Mike Ryan would buy horses for $150,000, $180,000. Like I mentioned earlier, Cut Campbell never spent $500,000 for horses, $400,000, or even basically hardly ever $300,000. He was always in the $150,000 to $250,000 range. Look at all the success he had with them. So they're there if you know what you're looking for. And you know what the key is, too, by the way, is that everybody wants the Maserati, the Lamborghini, is, you know. But the thing is, those horses are great. But then a few years later, the Lamborghinis, you know, and the Maseratis, all of a sudden, they're not running as well as the Chevys and the Fords. everything is good to have these glitzy ones. But the whole key to buying horses, and I've known a lot of people who've been successful buying horses, it's looking, not looking at the horse you're looking at, but looking at the horse, what he's going to be looking, what that horse will be
of course.
Year from now,
of course.
2 years from now. You know what I mean? You can have a big, beautiful horse and looks absolutely gorgeous. Listen, a lot of times they're going to grow up to be big and gorgeous. That doesn't make them great horses, but a lot of times if you look at a horse and you know what you're looking at, and you're saying, well, this horse has got this problem and that problem, but that doesn't bother me. I don't care if he's a bit sick or hot, though. I don't care if he's a bit off, you know, over in the knee a little bit, over this and that. But when this horse turns three or four, he's going to outgrow that, and he's going to develop into a beautiful horse. And those are the bloodstock agents that are the most successful, the ones that can project what horses are going to be like a year.
Absolutely. That's the whole thing, is understanding, you know, where they are on the growth curve, and understanding what the components were in the pedigree and where it contributes, and, you know, seeing those attributes in confirmation, and being able to understand, you know, where a horse is going to end up, and that, you know, that's the whole, particularly when it comes to the pinhookers, obviously. I mean, they're looking to spend as little as possible to then sell down the road for as much as possible.
And if they hit it big, and you know, that's their big. And again, that's exactly what pinhookers do. I mean, they're looking for the bargain basement yearlings that are weanlings or yearlings that are going to be tremendous the next year. A lot of time, how many times do you see yearlings sell for like $80,000 or so, or $100,000 or whatever, $70,000? Then they put them in a 2-year-old sale, and they work nine seconds, and they wind up selling for $900,000. You know, you don't know, you can't tell how fast the horse is going to be. Now, I'm not a big fan of the 2-year-old sales, because I mean, like I said.
Yeah, we've discussed this.
Yeah, we've discussed this many times. I'm not a fan. I see how long it takes these horses to recover from these crazy workouts. I just did a story on Mind Your Biscuits, by the way, who RNA'd every time he went into the sale. He RNA'd at the 2-year-old sale. Why? Because he was considered too slow because he only worked an eighth and 10 and 3. I mean, come on. When does a horse run 11 and change? in their life. They run 10-3 and they're too slow.
Yeah.
So I mean that's just that's
silly.
Okay. Anybody can go to a 2-year-old sale with, you know, $5 million on them and say, look, just get me the horse that runs, that works the fastest. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to do that. But listen, there's so many fascinating aspects of the sport, really. And I was, again, I was like, I still love watching watching the homebreds become successful, because all the old stables, all the old, you know, icons of the turf, they were all homebreds. They were born on the farm. They were raised on the farm. They went to the one trainer who, you know, all those trainers back then had 40 horses, and that was pretty much it. And then they wind up, either returning to the farm where they were born, or they'd be syndicated and retired to like a Claiborne farm. And you got to remember, a lot of the early horses that were syndicated for big bucks, and when I say big bucks, I'm talking about over $1 million. A lot of those horses were syndicated after they retired, not in February of their 3-year-old year, and you know where a breeder would lock onto them, and then they'd said, okay, well, you know, we'll buy the breeding rights, and he's going to retire him at the end of 3. Here, after the horse retired, and it was always at 4 or 5, then they syndicated these horses.
Well, that brings us back to where we started a little, and the ability to be in position to let a horse reach maturity and maximize their talent. And
that's why everybody should enjoy the Pacific Class, because this is the way, to me, again, as a, you know, I use the word historian. I use it maybe as a euphemism for an old person or something. somebody who's been around. These are kind of horses that I remember. You know, horses that stayed in training and got good at 4 and 5.
Yeah.
So it's refreshing to see. So that's why I'm a big fan of this year's Pacific Classic and a big fan of this year's Alabama.
It should be the Alabama. We haven't really talked yet, but it came up really interesting. And of course the 10 furlongs at this time of year. I say this every year, Steve. We spend so much time talking about 3-year-old boys going 1.25 miles for Derby, and then barely any time talking about the fillies going 1.25 miles for Alabama. And of course, we have the unique circumstance where we've got the Queen's Plate winner, and she's going to run in the Travers. She's one of the few out there that, you know, made 1.25 miles trip. The fillies, I thought this was as good a recent Alabama. You got some real intrigue to this.
Well, I tell you, to me, the fillies going into the Alabama, to me, is equivalent to the Colts going into the Belmont.
There you go.
Because that's a good
analogy,
too. Because they're
running
at a distance that they will never run again for the rest of their lives.
Well, although we do get, you know, there is a couple of standards. I mean, 1.25 miles for, you know, the Del Cap and personal Ensign.
Right. Delaware Handicap is the only other race. But it's not a typical distance. You know, it's a distance that they're running for the first time. But, you know, listen, it'll be interesting. Midnight Pursuit is a very, very talented filly. Now, you know, she is by Midnight Loot. She got stamina on the bottom, you know, through Repent. But, you know, it is a question of how far she wants to go. The one filly in the race that I'm seeing here as I'm looking at as a true 1.25 mile filly, who I think is going to be very tough in here. And I hate saying her name because I hate the name. And you know what I'm talking about. It's a talk voof to me. I mean,
Verb.
It's just a silly name. I don't know. I just don't like the sound of it. But anyway, I think she's a very good filly. I was very impressed with her in the Indiana Oaks. I know she didn't beat anything. The filly that she beat, actually, is the one I was talking about earlier. That's the highest-priced filly in this year's field at 250, this Figueroa's Queen. who looks like she's, you know, starting to come into her own a bit. But I was very impressed with this filly. And she's by violence, and she's out of a point-given mare. But she just looks like a filly that wants to go on. Now, she is picking up 6 pounds, and she is stretching out from a mile and a 16th to a mile and a quarter. So, you know, on paper, it looks like a question. But from a physical standpoint, from what I saw, she looks like she wants to go on. This filly sold to Keeneland September for $20,000. A violent, no less. A fashionable stallion. So you may have to wonder what's wrong. The one filly in the race that has me puzzled here is a filly who actually I bet who was my long shot special in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies is Pieri Bianchi. I thought she was 17-1 in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. I thought she was going to run a big race. I actually loved her races in the Del Mar Debutante and the Chandelier, and she looked like she wanted to go on. I thought she was coming up to a great race. And, you know, I mean, she ran average. She ran an even fifth in the race. But, you know, then she runs third in the Starlet. And then this year, she got one start at 6 furlongs, and now she's going a mile and a quarter. And I'm saying, what's that all about? That's not Todd Pletcher-like. I'm just wondering if it's an owner's decision. And, of course, one of the part owners is Saul Kuhlman, but what else is new? But, I mean, it's very unusual for a filly to have one 6-furlong race all year and an allowance race to boot, which she didn't even win. She was beaten 4 lengths in the race, now going a mile and a quarter. I just found that very, very, very interesting, very unusual to see this filly running in the race. It just doesn't seem like something that that Pletcher normally would do, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, style-wise, I will say this. Don't forget, you got a grade one. In this case, this race, there has been moments where it becomes a bit of a stagger fest. And, you know, if she can clunk along, if she can just kind of bide her time, save ground under Johnny and make one run, who knows? If she picks up grade one black type, nabbing third, that's what this gambit is.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can finish third. And listen, with fillies, you never know. I'm just saying it's an unusual thing to do.
Yeah, I hear you.
I mean, she's running 60s and 70 buyer numbers.
That's unfair. The one thing about I was intrigued when I saw her name right away, Steve, because there was quality about her as a 2-year-old.
No doubt about it. That's what I'm saying. That she was my pick in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies.
Well, that was silly.
You know? She's got two.
That was a bad pick.
It wasn't the best. you know, actually, Caledonia Road was the smart pick because Caledonia Road went into that race the same way Good Magic did. You know, one was coming off of this. They ran a very similar kind of races in the Champagne and the Frisette. She actually was the smart filly. But I just thought, I don't know, there was something about Pieri Bianchi watching her earlier races. So she does have a 2-year-old foundation, I'll give her that. But, you know, she's had, like I said, she's had 1 6-furlong race since December. Actually going on almost 1 6-furlong race in almost 9 months. So, you know, this is it's gonna take a big effort for her to run big here. But, I find her very... very intriguing. And then again, you know, you get fillies that are getting good now. Steve Asmussen's filly, She's a Julie, look good winning the Iowa Oaks. So we really don't know about her. Actually, it was the first race in her career that she was given Butte. So that's that was kind of unusual. And another filly that I actually loved early on, and I would love her here too, certainly to pick up a piece of it. I just don't know how far she wants to go, but when I saw Eskimo Kisses break her maiden earlier, when she broke her maiden by over 11 lengths at Oakland Park, I know it was in the slop, but then she came back in Fairgrounds Oaks and was absolutely flying at the end of that race and just missed catching Chocolate Martini, who, as we saw, you know, has come back and turned into a very good filly. He just ran, you know, third behind the two best three-year-old fillies in the country. And she just got beat ahead in that race. And I actually even liked her race in the Ashlane, you know, where Monomore Girl just went out there and just stole the race. And she was way too far back in there. And, you know, she closed, again, well enough to finish second, finished seven, over seven lengths ahead of the third horse, even though she couldn't threaten the winner. And then she, again, she didn't run bad. She had a bad post in the Kentucky Oaks. She was too far back early, and she finished a good fourth. Not that far behind Wonder Godot and Midnight Bisou and Monomoy Girl. I mean, she was beaten 4 3/4 lengths in there. I expected her to run a bit better in the CCA Oaks, and she just ran kind of evenly, but I think she just might have been too close to the pace. So the question is, you know, she's by To Honor and Serve out of a Mr. Greeley mare. So does she want to go 1 1/4? I don't know. If she can handle 1 1/4, you know, she gets Jose Ortiz for the first time. She's going to be a decent price. I've always liked this filly. I'm waiting for her to break out. Whether she can break out at 1 1/4, I don't know. But with her style of running that she showed in the Kentucky Oaks and the Ashland and the Fairgrounds Oaks, if she can get some kind of pace in here, she's definitely a filly to watch, I think. And Kenny McPeak, he has a way of knocking over some of these, you know, big price horses. You know, we remember the Travers a few years ago with Golden Ticket, and he's always Kenny's always around to he's always dangerous in these races.
Agreed.
So I would definitely definitely watch out for Eskimo Kid. I would definitely put her in my exotics. That's for sure.
It's a fun group, and tonight you'll have Dale Romans. You can
he'll talk about
ask him about. Coach Rocks, which would be a big thrill for Roddy Valenti, obviously. Steve, let me pull up. I got Julie Crone is going to join us. We're going to talk. She's coming to town for the unveiling of this, what's supposed to be a breathtaking bronze of Julie. And
where's that going?
In the Hall of Fame.
Oh, okay.
It's 3 feet, as Jay Hovde said, life size.
very well put.
Too funny. Steve, thanks a lot. This was great.
All right.
Steve asking everybody. And next week we'll handicap the Travers with Steve. Let's take a break. Coming up toward the bottom of the hour, I got to slip Rich Eng in, too. We got about 10 minutes with Rich and 15 minutes with Julie. So I'll leave it in Casey's hands. We can go in either direction. All right. Let's get Rich in here for 10, and then we'll close out with Julie. All right, Case. Perfect. We'll get some thoughts from Rich. See if he's got some ideas about Del Mar today. See if he's got a simulcast play at Saratoga as well. The scratches are up, and boy, they ain't much help if you're going to play this pick six. Pick six is really tough. All right. Final half hour here on this Thursday at the races.
The latest racing news. It's at the races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.